Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us by phone is John Gertner. He's the author of the new book, The Ice at the End of the World, An Epic Journey into Greenland's Buried Past and Our Perilous Future. John, thanks so much for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's start with some, you know what? Greenland's been in the news recently.
We know that.
In fact, Senator Tom Cotton wrote a little op-ed this morning in the New York Times about
why
you saw that, why we should purchase Greenland. There's a lot of more political and homeland security reasons behind that. Also natural resources. Maybe you can touch on that as we go forward. But let's get some background on Greenland itself. Just give us some physical facts about size and population and who owns it, et cetera.
Yeah. Well, Greenland's the world's largest island. That wouldn't include Australia, which is, if we classify that as a continent. And it's about three times the size of Texas or five times the size of California. And about 80% of Greenland is covered by an ice sheet. This has been built up over hundreds of thousands of years of snowfall that have compacted. And this ice sheet is the last remaining ice sheet in the northern hemisphere. And if we go back to the Ice Age, these ice sheets covered a lot of North America and northern Europe. They've all broken up and fallen into the sea. And, you know, as we read the news, you know, this summer especially, you know, the evidence that Greenland's ice sheet is melting more and more every year is become apparent, and it loses really hundreds of billions of tons of ice every summer into the ocean, and that in turn is raising sea levels. And that's, you know, one reason to care about Greenland is certainly these environmental impacts of this faraway place that really are impacting coastlines around the world. And, you know, the political aspects of Greenland are a little bit different, but one thing that the ice sheet, as it recedes, as it grows smaller, is it exposes, you know, areas of land that actually can be mined for resources. And the native Greenlanders, this is a very small population. There's really only 56,000 people living there. So this is really the least densely populated nation on Earth. But they have, you know, taken this opportunity in some ways to develop their economy through mineral extraction and, you know, the other parts of the economy up there that work are fishing and tourism as well. But there's also supposed to be some oil in the surrounding waters. I hope they don't drill for that oil because the climate, burning fossil fuels is making the climate warmer and it's melting the ice in Greenland, and it seems like we might get stuck in maybe even worse in the cycle that we're in now. But in a nutshell, you know, Greenland's important both for these environmental impacts that are really starting to affect our lives in faraway places, but as we know now, it also has potential for its, you know, economic value.
Well, in the book, you write a bit more about kind of like these changing perceptions of Iceland and how, you know, hundreds of years ago, it was just sort of seen as this like frozen wasteland, you know, with no use for anyone. But this started to change with early exploration. So tell us a little bit about kind of these first missions, explorations of Greenland.
Sure. I mean, Greenland was really the edge of the known world. I mean, really, you know, it was settled, I mean, in two ways. One was native Inuit settlers came over from Canada over the ice, like probably 800 years ago. But also Europeans came over from Iceland and elsewhere and from Denmark, anywhere from the year 950 and then later from Denmark in the 1700s. This place was even then very inhospitable. I mean, this was a place where farming was almost impossible. Agriculture was incredibly difficult. So, I mean, for the native Inuit and for the settlers who came, it was really a hunting and fishing sort of culture. But early on, it sort of stoked the imaginations of some of the early settlers. You know, there's this immense ice sheet in the center of the island. Could it be crossed? What's in the middle of there? What is it hiding? And so, you know, my book, I sort of wrestled with this question that, you know, when do you begin the story of Greenland and its ice? And really, I settled on a time in the late 1800s when really the first great explorer of Greenland, Fridtjof Nansen, who was a Norwegian, decided that he was going to be the first person to cross this massive ice cap in the middle. And after Nansen successfully did this, a wave of explorers followed. And I think what's interesting, or what was interesting to me in writing the book, is eventually this age of exploration kind of became an age of science. And some of those early explorers were scientists, and even later, some of the scientists were sort of explorers in a way. And really, it began with these kind of horrific crossings where, you know, the starving, you know, men who were trying to get across this massive ice sheet were, you know, with dog teams oftentimes were barely able to survive.
So Greenland, not so green in that sense. And
right.
even back then, you say that 80% of the island is covered in an ice sheet. Back then, it was probably even more. And so the trend is going down from 80%.
Yeah, I mean, we have pretty accurate readings. I mean, one of the, I think, important things that both I learned as a reporter working on this book, but that also, I think, gets lost sometimes in the news from day to day, is how accurate we are at being able to measure the decline of these ice sheets. And a lot of this work were sort of technological breakthroughs by NASA satellites and other space agencies. So when I say Greenland loses on average 286 billion, that's B as in Bravo, billion tons of ice per year that's going into the ocean, I mean, we have really pretty good estimates from a variety of different methods, mostly a satellite called GRACE that flies over the Earth and measures the gravitational pull of the ice. But the idea that Greenland's ice sheet is diminishing is on very solid scientific ground. We can measure it fairly accurately from year to year. We can even see it from day to day with satellites that look at how much of the surface is melting. There's even a website, Greenland Ice Sheet Today, that tells you how much of the surface is melting on any given day.
Wow.
So that 80% of Greenland that's covered with ice is for sure receding. I think one of the important points is that not only is the ice cap diminishing, and not only is it raising sea levels, but the loss of ice seems to be accelerating. And so, you know, we can look at what Greenland loses in ice per year and say, well, that's only like a millimeter. That's a tiny amount that sea levels are going up, but it's also accelerating. So if we look ahead 20, 30, 40 years, we can look at something that's very, very significant, especially if you're living close to the ocean.
And talk a little bit about the feedback loop that it goes on with respect to melting and receding ice.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point, and it's super important to understand that part of that ice melt accelerating, you know, the melting that's accelerating, is because there are these feedback loops that, in a way, the more Greenland melts, the more it is in danger of melting. And, you know, to use one example of these feedback loops, I mean, Greenland's ice sheet isn't like a flat piece of ice that sits on Greenland. It's more like a dome of ice. Mm. And in the center of it, it's about 2 miles thick, and it's 10,000 feet in altitude. But as Greenland melts, the elevation of the ice sheet goes down. And at those higher elevations, it's at a lower temperature, so
sure,
it's colder and it stays frozen. But as this ice sheet goes down in elevation, especially closer to the coasts, it's more susceptible to melting. So the more it melts, the more it goes down in elevation. The more it goes down in elevation, the more it melts. And it kind of enters into this sort of vicious cycle where it really becomes jeopardized, really, by the warmer temperatures.
So with a lot of these impacts being seen closer to the coast, where I think most of the population lives, like, how is this impacting the communities that live there now? Like, how are they adapting to this?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. I mean, I've talked to hunters in Greenland who are having a difficult time because these sort of traditional methods of hunting on the ice for polar bears and seals has changed. On the other hand, it has afforded economic opportunities. Harbors that were once iced in all year long are now accessible year-round. So if, you know, some of the fishermen, you know, for shrimp or halibut or seal have boats, they can kind of, you know, certainly make a year-round job of working as fishermen. And, of course, if you're involved with this very young mineral extraction economy, aspect of the economy, that too offers potential. So, you know, there's that sort of kind of, on the one hand, the loss of ice has threatened sort of traditional methods of hunting, but it's offered other opportunities. I think it creates other environmental problems too that the population certainly seems concerned about based on some recent polls and interviews I've done and have read. I mean, for instance, when the ice sheet melts, it can create massive floods on these coastal towns as huge, really, rivers of meltwater come down through rivers off the ice sheet to the coast so they can find a way to the ocean. And, you know, it's in the past has washed away bridges and has even threatened the viability of small villages. So that's a threat as well. It's a number of different kind of impacts, some of which are, opportunities, and certainly some of which are cause for worry.
Right. We're speaking with John Gertner about his new book titled The Ice at the End of the World, An Epic Journey into Greenland's Buried Past and Our Perilous Future. So, John, you visited Greenland 6 times. What were some of the big takeaways on these visits?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of people sometimes think, oh, it's like Iceland, which is this kind of very heavily populated small island, volcanic island. And Greenland is completely different. I mean, when you first get there, there's no trees. It's really a very kind of sparse, beautiful ice and rock and lakes, you know, endless lakes. And I think one of the first things certainly that struck me and that as I made repeated visits continued to impress me was, you know, how the low density of the island, how few people actually live there, that it really does feel like a whole other world, like an unsettled place in many ways. On the other hand, when you visit villages and small towns there, you do get a flavor for a way of life that's, you know, certainly very different than life in the U.S., a kind of mix of tradition where technology is kind of only made sort of limited inroads. And I don't say that in a critical way at all. It's in many ways kind of wonderful to get away, to be there. But I think overall, it sort of seemed to me, you know, one of the last unspoiled places, which, you know, in light of the recent conversations amongst politics that we should, you know, buy Greenland and mine Greenland, develop Greenland, made me sort of worried a little bit in the sense of, well, no, that's certainly not what Greenland is. You have a kind of, you know, fiercely proud native population and a beautifully, beautifully unspoiled country that is, at the moment at least, under threat from climate change.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about that. The impacts, you talked about the impacts on a local level from climate change and melting ice to Greenland itself. So what does it mean to, say, the U.S. and other coastal waters as far as this amount of water ice that's being melted?
Yeah, I mean, if we take a step back and sort of look at sea level rise projections, and I know a lot of the folks listening are not living by the water, being in Utah. On the other hand, everybody seems to know somebody on the coast, wherever it might be. So what we have now are 3 real major factors that are pushing up sea levels around the world. And one is that as it gets warmer, water expands. So that's thermal expansion. And then the other is that these sort of mountain glaciers all over the world, in Himalayas and South America and Canada, are melting and dripping into the sea, in Alaska as well. And then the third factor are these ice sheets, one in Antarctica and one in Greenland, that really carry the bulk of this frozen water and the biggest threat to rising sea levels. And altogether, sea levels are rising about 3 millimeters per year, but again, they're accelerating. And Greenland, in all of its ice, has about enough ice there to raise sea levels probably about 24 feet. Now, Antarctica has even more ice. It's not all going to slide into the ocean tomorrow or even 10 years or 50 years or 100 years, but I think, you know, as somebody who lives on the East Coast, you know, one of the biggest dangers is that even if, you know, some of the projections for the year 2100 are that sea levels, you know, they could rise 2 feet or they could rise 5 feet. But even, you know, there's so much low-lying exposed land. There's so much sort of vulnerability at the coast, I think, that even, you know, a sea level rise of 1 feet or 2 feet with a storm surge, you know, that we saw and that I've experienced on the East Coast, you know, the damage that can occur economically and to some extent how it impacts lives can just be enormous. So, you know, if Greenland adds a foot or two of sea level rise by the end of the century, that would be, you know, an enormous and very, very consequential impact. And then I think if we look at our children's children, if we start looking even farther ahead, you know, Greenland, if we go on this kind of road we're on now, Greenland and Antarctica can really add just tremendous amounts of water to the oceans and raise sea levels. And there may be some other impacts, too. Greenland's ice may change ocean currents, and that, too, may affect weather patterns, climate patterns. It may have very significant impacts on sea levels as well, as it changes not only the jet stream patterns for weather, but also for especially for the Gulf Stream and how that affects the weather and the actual sea levels on the East Coast.
Yeah.
So all in all, it's kind of a domino effect where this frozen faraway island that we really don't think about very much may end up having really quite a lot of impact on our lives in the future, especially for people living on the coast.
Right.
So this book was released a couple of months ago, and Greenland, mm-hmm. I feel like, is a topic that, like, we haven't heard as much about. We hear about the Arctic ice melting or things like that, but mm-hmm. I'm really curious about the kind of response that you've gotten to the book and the information in the book.
Sure. Well, yeah, and as you point out, the Arctic ice, which is the floating ice over the North Pole, is melting as well, and that's creating opportunities and problems both in terms of shipping lanes and also military trying to control that area.
Yeah.
But, you know, I would say, you know, the response has been, you know, quite good critically, and I think Greenland is something, again, that it's not something we in the United States think much about. I mean, even though the U.S. has a very large Air Force military base in northern Greenland, and we've had one up there for more than 50 years, it's really kind of off our radar, so to speak. And at least for me, it's been gratifying talking about this book and saying, you know, this is not only an interesting story of how we've explored this frozen, faraway world, but it's a place that seems to, you know, really have some real impact on our lives now, but in the coming decades will be incredibly important. So, yeah, I get probably an email or two every day, and certainly, like, you know, on radio stations and radio shows, callers, you know, asking really kind of interesting questions. But I think, I guess I would say I've been, you know, gratified by how interested people are in the book, but also it's true. It's surprising. It's not something people have been thinking about. That is until the president decided that, you know, maybe it was a good idea to talk about buying Greenland, and then all of a sudden people were talking about Greenland.
Right.
And even I was sort of shocked and surprised that all of a sudden Greenland became a hot topic of conversation.
Did you time that with the release of your book,
yeah,
John?
Look at you.
did my book actually get him to talk? Well, it could.
Maybe. Well, I want to go back again. You know, we talk about Arctic sea ice and Greenland. Land ice,
right.
It's land ice that raises water levels. Sea ice, when it melts, doesn't raise the water levels. But sea ice, when it melts, contributes, again, to that feedback loop by taking away a white reflective surface and turning it into a dark absorbing surface. So there's an impact associated with Arctic sea ice melting.
Absolutely. I mean, as the ice recedes, that's a perfect description. You know, the solar energy and radiation is reflected back mostly from this bright white surface, and as the ocean sort of is exposed and darkened, it absorbs more solar energy, and the Arctic that is already warming warms more, and more sea ice melts. And there are interactions as well with the melting of the sea ice, the warming of the Arctic, and of course the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. So it's kind of connected in a very, very large and complex ecosystem of not only ice and water and warmth and air warmth, all these things working together in a very complex way. And scientists now are trying to unravel that. For instance, as the Arctic ice, the sea ice, the floating ice diminishes, what will be the net effect on Greenland's land ice? Mm. You know, how much faster will it melt? Will it melt faster? How much warmer will the Arctic get? as these processes sort of gain speed. And I think, you know, one point I've often made is that, you know, this science is pretty new. I mean, it's not like we've been observing this stuff for hundreds of years. I mean, for instance, we've only been measuring really accurately the Greenland ice sheet for about 20 years. Mm. And really, you know, it takes a good amount of time to build up a scientific record that has rigor and can be sort of, you know, shows these trend lines. So a lot of scientists are really, you know, grappling with understanding the connections and also understanding the data so they can look ahead and see what the models might tell them about the future. And all those things are crucially important, and we're still, I think, really coming to terms with what this means.
So, John, I have to ask, what was the motivation for you? Like, what kind of caught your attention or your imagination mm-hmm. about Greenland? Was it like, were you coming at this because of the importance to our, you know, climate and the climate impacts? Or was it like the crazy early exploration? What was it that kind of thought, like, that made you think, I should write a book about this?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I mean, for me, I had been writing about climate change at the New York Times Sunday Magazine. And I wondered, you know, is there a way to do a book? And or what would the book be? And there been a lot of books on climate change, and some of them very, very good. And I sort of was looking for a way to do it that might sort of involve history and sort of look at not only why Greenland matters, because it has all this ice that will melt and raise sea levels, but also maybe what does it say about the process of scientific discovery? And I say that because my first book was about innovation at a laboratory, and it's kind of like how innovation happens. And so with Greenland, I was looking both at the climate impacts, but I thought maybe it would kind of shed some light on kind of this bigger question of like how science happens and how we learn what we learn, how we get to know what we know, and how we sort of test it and explore it and sort of come to terms with it. So those were sort of the main two reasons, that sort of desire to kind of put a frame around a climate change story that to me was epic, as they put in the subhead, and about explorers and scientists and technology, but also that might shed some light just really on how science happens and also sometimes how hard it is to gain new knowledge, and, you know, especially about a topic that's so complicated like climate and the Arctic.
The name of the book is The Ice at the End of the World, An Epic Journey into Greenland's Buried Past and Our Perilous Future. John Gertner is the author. John, do you have a website or so that people can
Sure, I do, actually. It's just johngertner.net, and there's no H in John, so it's johngertner.net. And yeah, sure, come visit me and, you know, read the book, buy the book, take it out of the library, and I'd be delighted if you took a look.
Perfect. Well, we're delighted that you took the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth, so thank you very much.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.